Hey, Carol, who's here?
Hi, Carol, this is Barb Riley.
Hello, Barb. Ladies, this is Irma.
Hi. You guys look so beautiful right now. I guess we're a couple of the first ones, got a couple of minutes, so let's talk about them.
Right? Oh, yeah, I was reading my notes here. So doing my answering the questions, my money equation, so I'm thinking, gosh, what if I spent this been over $100?
Yeah.
I could only come up with two things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I almost bought a Dooney and Burke purse from QVC. I recorded it and saw a purse like, oh, I gotta have it. So I ordered it, then realized that's too much money and I really don't need it. So I canceled the order. So I was proud of myself.
Hey, I'm proud of you too. Lost by
yourself,
don't we?
Yeah, especially when the purse came out to $300. Yeah, four easy payments, but still, it's still $300.
Yeah, it is.
I got totally confused because I don't know if I'm supposed to be proud of you or not. Because I don't know what my money story ought to be.
Yeah. Gosh, this week has gone fast.
Well, money is security, which is typically a woman, and from what I read, and doesn't surprise me. But also from growing up, it just seems like my money story is there's never enough, or there's always something's going to happen, and you're going to need it, so you need to hang on to it. Don't buy that, you know, that kind of thing. So then it's kind of like you have a money story of clinging to money instead of abundance, and so. And I've heard contrary recently that, you know, that if you do that, then you're always going to be not having enough, and then you ought to have more of an abundance attitude, and then you'll always have enough. So that's why I said that about I don't know what my money story ought to be. I'm kind of confused.
Hey, well, welcome. This is Dave Kruger. Don't let me interrupt good gossip here. I think you have a great discussion going. let me log in on something that neuroscience shows us, and we're going to be talking about this, that we get what we focus on, not what we want. We align ourselves to focus on something, and then that's what our energy field is focused on, and we draw. And the law of attraction is based in neuroscience, and it fulfills that. So I think when you're writing a surface story of, you know, I want to create wealth, but then the shadow story is in an equal and opposite direction of, well, I don't think I should really have money, then you're writing two stories simultaneously. So there's not a should here, but a what do you want your money story to be so that all of you can be aligned to go to the same direction. This is exactly what we do in coaching. Think about how we use SMART goals to help someone establish a goal and then establish strategies to get there. How we align needs and ideals of the individual so that all of them is going in the same direction. And then that's where we're going to bring in some aspects of mind and brain to help us understand how to strategically do that, because we want to focus not on what we don't do or can't have, but what we do want. And in fact, that's the story of why some people get stuck in therapy. Because the more you focus on something, the more you etch it in your brain. So even though with good intention of revising an old story or coming to the end of the old story or creating a better ending, you re-enter the process. So 1,000 better endings later, you've recreated the process, and each time you've etched that further in your brain. So despite the best intentions, it's a stuckness and a frustration. So what we do in coaching is something really different of look at possibilities instead of problems, of the choice architecture of this moment going forward and strategizing about how to do that. So what we're going to do now in a more systematic way is address exactly the question you ask in these next three seminars and the roadmap process, the seven steps to recognize, understand. It will be exactly to address that question. It's going to take us three seminars to do it, which is why there's no quick, easy answer. Does that make sense to you? And who is this? I didn't recognize your voice. Sorry.
It was Barb Riley that said that I don't know what my story ought to be.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm right where I ought to be.
Yeah. In coaching, whenever we hear a client say, you know, should or ought or, you know, that's a coachable moment because that's an external authority to say, you know, what should it be? What should I do? What do I need to do? That means that the point of reference needs to be inside the individual to author his or her own story and to take that point of reference internally about how you align yourself to pursue exactly what you want. So you've already begun, but let's check in. Now that the first seminar is kind of marinated in your mind and you're doing some exercises in the workbook, what's your experience of beginning in this way? Well, we can always resume your gossip. You guys were lively until I came on.
Back to that $300 purse I wanted.
Okay. Now, I understand why you didn't identify yourself.
By the way, this is Yidma Osborne.
Okay. Hey.
One of the things I was talking earlier to a friend of mine who's done the Dave Ramsey program and has done very well, and is $600 away from eliminating all of her credit card debt.
Yeah.
But a situation she's had is that one of her relatives had to move about 3 hours away from here, so now she and her husband visit that relative about twice a month. And she said, if we didn't do the traveling, we would have already eliminated that debt. And I was thinking, well, here's how I look at life sometimes. Okay, we want to eliminate debt. Nothing's wrong with that. So we quit seeing relatives that we love and so forth. What if, you know, a month later they die? And that's happened in my case. Of course, I have some relatives in Mexico that because I haven't been able to purchase a passport, I haven't been able to go and see them. And about a year ago, I had an uncle who passed away suddenly, and I was not able to go. And sometimes I think, okay, yes, I'm getting rid of debt, which is great, but when emergencies happen, you know, like taking a trip out of the country, that's not something easy, you know, to do. So that's, okay, you know, one of my dilemmas at times.
Okay, that's really well put. Now, what is your question from that? What is your question of yourself out loud so that we can hear it and maybe speak to it?
Mm-hmm. While trying to eliminate debt, which also deals with eliminating travel to see friends and family, what is the right thing to do at certain times when you want to see family members because you don't know if they may be around, you know, another year or so? What's the right thing to do?
Okay, let me approach that question in a somewhat different way. First, by responding to the process of the question, and then to try to answer it as best I can. I think the point of reference is a little bit outside yourself because, in a true sense, there isn't a right or wrong or good or bad any more than there's an ultimate arbiter of fairness. Because that's part of what we accept in adulthood, is that we are our own authority, and we determine for us, as best we can, in our best judgment, what's the best thing to do, and what's the next best thing after that. What I want to send you guys is a first module it's a curriculum. The curriculum is called Live a New Life Story, The Owner's Guide. Because I want to have you look at two exercises. exercises in this module about looking at ideals and looking at needs, because the answer to your question is going to be an internal one about what are your ideals and how can you align decisions with those ideals and with those needs, because that's exactly what you need to address, in my view, and we need to help clients address when they establish goals and strategies, is to align their ideals with their needs. Out of all of the exercises and work tools, out of that entire curriculum, and there are, you know, a couple hundred, those are the two exercises that I most regularly recommend a client to do, to look through the list or make up ones if they're not included, to look at the top three ideals that they have, the values that they have, because when we have ideals, that's who and what we want to live up to, and that's the only place I know that self-esteem comes from. And then the top three needs, so that those ideals or values and needs can be incorporated into decision-making process to be sure that whatever decisions take into account those needs and those ideals for that individual. So that becomes, at this point in time, the best way we can determine what's right now for us, because it's very relative. Now, does that even begin to answer your question in your mind?
It does. It does. But as you put it, looking at the ideals and needs, so that's helping me understand my situation. Like you said, Gio, writing out your top three.
So I'll send this as an attachment tomorrow to you, and I'll indicate in the email which pages these two exercises are on, and just look at them and see if it helps you with decisions like that, because the person standing to your left and the person standing to your right may have that same situation but come to a very different conclusion. And each of the three of you need to live with that and to have it be consistent with your life and your own values and your story, because you're each writing your own story. And whatever we think and feel and experience is what we create each moment. So that's how we write our story. That's what we do as coaches, is to look at the choice architecture of this moment to help a client make the most informed choice possible. Any other thoughts or questions or reflections about what you've read, what we talked about last time, that would be helpful for us to talk about briefly before we move into the material?
Anybody else
want to just check in and gossip a little bit?
My name is Lynn.
Lynn, hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you. And I just have a comment about, I don't remember the woman's name who was just talking. And I'm on a very, very tight budget. I'm going through a horrific divorce. I have very little money. And what am I spending it on? I'm spending it on being with my friends and going out to dinner. And I've made that choice because that is going, at this point in time, that is my mental therapy. That's my mental health. So other things that I probably could be spending money on, like Christmas gifts and things like that, I don't spend money there. I'm spending, because my value right now is to be in a social situation so I don't get depressed and so I'm taking care of myself.
Uh-huh.
Now, is that sort of what you were meaning?
Yes, absolutely. You're writing your story in the most informed way possible based on your needs and values at this point in time.
You're not doing it
for somebody else to evoke a certain response from someone else. You're doing it based on your needs and your ideals. And that sounds like a very authentic story.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for the sharing of that and the perspective. Anyone else? Well, if there are no other comments, I'll move into the material, and we'll have some time at the end then to discuss and to clarify and ask questions. We're going to talk today about translating money meanings. We've discussed your money story and the concept of writing a new money story. Now we're going to look closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. We'll examine the essential steps of change to create a new money story that can be successful and fulfilling. You can roadmap a new money story. Remember, I'm suggesting that you do this work and the exercises first, and you'll be better able to apply it with your clients, but it'll bring it alive for you. We're going to apply these 7 steps to understand your money story in order to revise or to create a new one that can be successful and fulfilling. And this is an overview of the roadmap, the 7 steps. Recognize authorship. You're writing your money story from assumptions to every choice about earning, spending, and saving. Second step, own your story. Accountability is a prerequisite to change. Assess the plot and storylines. Recognize the behaviors, hidden messages, and elusive language at times of mind and emotion. Then decide what to change. Make informed choices about what story components to keep, to let go, to change, or to enhance. Map changes, goals, and success strategies. Then author new experiences. Create the money story you desire. And then finally, and this is a very important step in my view, program new identity. Incorporate and sustain the changes by a corresponding internal shift. In other words, you change the model of how and who you see yourself to be to reprogram that, to incorporate it, not as just something you've done, but as who you are now. Now, in this seminar, we'll discuss the first 3 steps of the roadmap. First step, recognize authorship of your money story. Remember the premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us. They are created by us. Yet so often the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. You have to have a new story to be in before you can create an old one. And we'll think about at a later point how exactly literally that works in the mind. You leave the superhighway of the familiar and you cut a new trail. You're in a new pathway that feels uncertain, but you can't be two places at the same time. So here are 4 principles in recognizing authorship in this first step. Principle 1, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Let me give you an example. This is out of Oxford, happened a number of years ago. 2 anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They didn't communicate with each other. They were chosen because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. The 2 anthropologists lived for a year, then emerged to compare notes, and they expected essential similarities but found remarkable discrepancies. 1 anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a real harmony and unity, a real comfort with the apes. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful, vigilant, always right on the cusp of some kind of conflict, never achieved that harmony or unity. The anthropologists and their teams could not understand the discrepant results or find any reason. They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, had a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they then experienced. And they were, of course, each right. We tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle 2. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. And some things you have to believe in order to see. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. A story can even define possibility. And each of you know about this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. Then, in 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Within the following 12 months, over a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, what we register, and then how we process it. We construct our storylines from these premises. We have to bring our beliefs about money, finances, and wealth into conscious focus, like you were discussing when I came on, to assess how well they work in present time. Here's a real-life example. One couple married a week before Black Friday, beginning the Great Depression, 1929. The poverty and scarcity of their situation centered on the reality and the metaphor of the Depression-era finances. Money was elusive for this family with 7 children, and they often struggled even just to have food. They were proud that they had never gone on relief, on welfare. This required the father to be away for several months at a time, finding work in other states. Finally, after years of being exhausted and tired, the mother agreed to accept relief. Around this time, she had bartered canning vegetables for almost 3 years to have her home painted. Someone in the welfare agency passed by and saw her freshly painted house. He called her and wondered, since she could afford to have her home painted, did they really need to be on relief? This proud woman responded, "You know, just take it back. I don't want it." For this family, money you didn't earn had strings attached. Their experience of the scarcity of money became a legacy amalgamating their life and money stories. 3 generations later, her granddaughter was going through a post-divorce move and adjustment with a difficult financial time supporting her 2 children, but she was adamant about not asking for anything. She was determined, as she put it, not to become one of those people who took welfare. She carried the same torch of pride as her grandmother. And she said, "One of my children refused to eat the free lunch that she was offered at school because choices were limited. Her great-grandmother learned that you gave up certain freedoms with a free lunch." The choices we make as parents are models that our children then emulate. They look and experience. They take unconscious notes. These notes get passed on. They get passed on while we're talking about other things. We know that so many beliefs and behavioral patterns are downloaded during the first years of life without even conscious recognition. Neuroscientists estimate now that 95% of our operating system is unconscious, much of it downloaded from beginning, even before there were words in a language. Principle 3. A new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, and think about what we do and how we do this in coaching, you affect their future behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of they're going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" The question increased purchase rates 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise, to regularly fund retirement plans. The stated intention is most powerful when it's coupled with a specific action plan. Principle 4. Our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. And here's a series of studies that really illustrate this to me in a very vivid way. Dr. Dan Gilbert of Harvard showed volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. It was like 1/50th of a second. This was such a short time that they were unaware that the words were shown and couldn't even pick them out or guess from a multiple choice. This was subliminal programming. Yet they were influenced by them. And they were influenced by them for a period of 45 to 50 minutes after the words were flashed, for that period of time. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform slightly less well on tests. Now, when these volunteers were asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, they were not aware of it. But then they immediately came up with some reason. They achieved a closure by an explanation. For example, the volunteers who walked more slowly would come up with such reasons as, well, you know, I was a little tired when I did the test, or I've been traveling the last few days, I haven't slept well, or I'm jet lagged. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. These findings demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure in two different ways. For our brains to end any dissonance by imposing a certainty, and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation that infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth. A finish without an ending. An application of this principle. A scam artist can create a cult-like following by offering an evocative promise that touches people's vague, hazy dreams to make them appear vividly in reach. They want to believe the story they hear. It's our innate optimism bias. The picture painted allows people to see what they want to see. People project their own desires onto a promising story that crystallizes a fantasy, for example, of magical wealth. The scam artist is half of the co-created story of the scam. The victim completes the other half. Now, I'd suggest you do the four exercises of step one to be sure you get the foundation of really recognizing your money story and your authorship of it. And remember the basic ideas of any story. These two, plot, the core themes and storylines of money stories that inform what you look for, and then how you attribute meaning to what you find. And storylines. Your money story is your self-statement. Every time you make, use, or save money, you're making a self-statement. Step two, own your story. For this, I'd suggest you review the assumptions and motivations that construct storylines, the exercise on page 2.5 of the workbook. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the million bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet or health club membership, won't likely make an impact unless you change the software. No, it's sort of like 95% of people who diet and lose weight gain back the weight. They change their body and their weight, but they don't change the software, the body image. As we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation, this is in your outline, that I think will be useful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs also influence reality and behavior. They have an effect emotionally and physically. You'll hear them in your clients, directly or by inference. You know, I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. I don't make enough to save anything. Notice that these examples include a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. Our imagination is limitless in its ability to create scenarios of disaster or success. first you have to recognize each experience as a choice rather than just the way things are. Here's a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Let me slightly amend that. In adulthood, whatever you experience, you either create or accept. And some stories are perpetuated outside awareness. Now, I want to apply that notion by us talking about two aspects, point of reference and then active versus passive positions. Consider these two sets of ideas, especially as you do the exercises on can you make and enjoy money and money myths. First, point of reference. The point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. This theme can include passivity or resignation. Their assumption is helplessness. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. Here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. There's nothing I can do. They feel vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. Now, I'm giving examples because every one of these I consider a coachable moment. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. That's just the way I am. You know, some of these examples are way too easy for me to say, by the way, here. They believe that they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. And when they experience a symptom in their bodies, for example, they medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and turning off the bulb rather than pursuing the problem. Now, consider the alternative here. Those with an internal point of reference, this is what we coach toward if someone doesn't have, those with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. They know that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are some characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. If they experience an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result, then look for alternatives. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and then initiate that change. They realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose and you can choose how you choose. Let's also consider now active versus passive positions. Sometimes the story seems to just write itself, to just happen to you. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. I can't seem to put money into savings. It just seems to keep happening. Again, every one of these, a coachable moment that I would interrupt someone, play it back, and examine it. You have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. And I heard this in person recently from a prominent neuroscientist, Dr. Bruce Lipton, and I mentioned this in our discussion. 95% of people have no genetic basis for their unhappiness, their fears, or what they're taking medication for. These passive positions disown the feelings, thoughts, or actions as an active creation, as if the feeling you create makes you its victim. So the story then becomes like an identity. I'm a risk taker. I'm a bargain hunter. So it can take on a life of its own. For example, somebody creates credit card debt and then personifies it to become a victim of its demand and threat, a victim of its influence to decrease a credit score, and even take on a life of its own, as if the company that agreed to loan you money on your word to pay it back suddenly has a malevolent intent. They want you to keep your deal. Review the exercise 17 Common Money Storylines examine the storylines as objectively as possible, not to judge or criticize yourself, but to inform. Now, once recognizing and owning your money story, step three is assess your money story plot and storylines. I know we're compressing this quickly, and hopefully you'll expand it by doing the exercises. A belief, and this is so important for coaching, a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. It's a physical part of a neuronal network. A teacher can't simply present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from his student's brain. You can't just list the three reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange someone's neural network and neuronal pathways, or expect that presenting a new fact is going to just overwrite the one that's already there. But change can occur as a process, not an event, and it's an inside job. This step is to assess beliefs to see if they're limiting, and if they are, to look at systematically trying out other beliefs. What's another way to look at this? How might my thoughts be limiting me? Who has a different perspective on this? Are there other questions I'm afraid to ask? At some level, you know what they are. Remember, denial is a powerful engagement. So's a secret. What do I really want? What do I need to let go? And here's, actually, this is in your workbook. We were talking about this earlier, and I'd forgotten that I included it in this workbook. Distinguish and address ideals and needs. This begins in your workbook, beginning page 3.5. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. And I mentioned, this is an exercise I find useful with every executive and professional I work with, to inform us both about aligning goals and strategies with fundamental needs and ideals, to be sure all of someone's going in the same direction. Ideals are internal standards of excellence. They serve as a personal model of value, an internal guide to purpose. Living up to a personal, attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. Failure to live up to an internal ideal results in the feeling of shame. This is something I think we really need to appreciate, and probably appreciate more in coaching, because shame is about not living up to an internal ideal. Because we don't have enough time right now, what I'd like to do is to refer you to my blog. It's in the archives, called The Psychology of Shame and Your Money Story. There's more about it there, and more about the gender specificity of shame, because shame shows up differently in women as it shows up in men. Needs now. Needs are essential requirements, a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. Unmet, frustrated needs create discomfort. A need may be most obvious when it's not met. And I think it's important to distinguish wants from needs. You can get sick if you don't have enough of a need. You can get sick if you have too much of a want. And you can never get enough of what you don't need. Now, let's talk about comfort zones for just a moment. We did the thumb exercise last seminar. I want to ask each of you, just while we're discussing this section, if you would please put your watch on the other wrist. I'll give you just a second to do that, if you would indulge me for just a moment. And notice how it feels. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We even have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. It's familiar. A comfort zone is not necessarily comfortable. It's just familiar. It's predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program or a savings program. A comfort zone can be the repeated role you play in a relationship, the behavior or the attachment pattern, procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make, or establishing a structured savings plan. A comfort zone can show itself in certain patterns, storylines, or even in recurring characters. An example, working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating a crisis, the stimulation of the adrenaline and cortisol to have that flourish or finish can be a little addictive. All can be comfort zones. For example, somebody can be an underdog and succeed against all odds. This can become a comfort zone of behavior in which the same pattern is then repeated. See how it can be complex patterns of behavior that play out over a time period that's not just an immediate reversion back like a thermostat. Here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In fact, in the U.S., 80% of lottery winners over $3 million file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, they ended up returning to it. Here's another example. A simple Irish woman lived an ordinary life in a small village in Ireland for over 4.5 decades. Then, suddenly, she was vaulted onto the world stage with Britain's Got Talent. One of the initial results is that Susan Boyle became overwhelmed and had to be hospitalized the day after the final completion. She, like the lottery winners, wasn't motivated to sabotage herself, but she got on overload way beyond her comfort zone. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to remain in it. The choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone. But a comfort zone trades passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. Remember, a habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. So, to break out of your comfort zone, your performance, even the money you make, operates in the same way. If people get more successful, they feel vaguely uncomfortable, just different. If the results go outside their self-image, it cues an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Once something that's unconscious is recognized, it's no longer unconscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Your brain has a mind of its own. Now, put your watches back on your usual risk. I appreciate that. It would take for a simple piece of behavior like this 25 to 30 days to etch a new pathway in your brain for it to feel natural. Now, more complex patterns take longer, sometimes a few months. But the good news is that unlike the NASA astronauts where they had to start back at square one the day out of the headgear, you revert back. It doesn't cause you to go back to square one. You self-correct and move ahead, and you still create the new pattern in your brain. Now, part of the assessment of your money story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory, not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We often are not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. A dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. For example, if you read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead, or uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. A current paradigm, or something we may need to help our client reframe, a current paradigm reframes the excitement and trepidation of moving ahead in new territory as a signpost to progress, because you don't begin with comfortable. Another example, we need to be afraid of the right thing. We fear what's easily remembered. We fear what we can't control. It's way more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car than in your airplane seat 18C, but in that airplane seat, we may feel less control. It's an availability bias of prediction based on greater emotional charge. Another example, smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their life by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. People may fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime way more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks on a daily basis. One of the unique qualities that we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits and our thoughts. We created them. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. Now, there are a lot of studies to show that money is not related to happiness and many other things that it promises or represents. But here's one relationship as you think about saving for the future. And this is a continuation. Are you afraid enough of the right thing, of not having abundance in later years, to plan and save sufficiently for it now? The one thing that money influences, the one meaning and dynamic it has for all classes, all groups of people, choice. So we can assess our money stories in four ways. Monitor our choices, question our ideas, probe our reasoning, ask clearly and honestly, does it work? Now, here's a quote for the guys, because we're inevitably the ones who will not stop and ask for directions, even when we're hopelessly lost. This is from C.S. Lewis. He said, "We all want progress, but progress means getting nearer to the place where you want to be. And if you've taken a wrong turn, then to go forward does not get you any nearer. If you're on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man." You know, notice even Lewis said man. You're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So it's helpful to make them conscious and see if they're working or not. If your personal or professional life is not as gratifying as you would like, if you believe you've not attained your objectives, look more closely. It's helpful to know consciously and specifically what those goals are. You might be undermining your success by being too vague in your objectives. Do you fear specifically, yet dream vaguely? For example, if you want to change your body, as I was mentioning a moment ago, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self. Not a false body self of overweight or out of shape, then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. So is your savings account. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says that there's not a full commitment, a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. You know the words of someone not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When someone says, "I'm going to try to stop drinking," you know that they're going to continue drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. Now, let's talk finally about creating a new belief. How we tell our stories of the past shape our future. Some stories get told so much or so often they achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it regularly. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. Now, here's a brief story to illustrate how we value and attribute, how the belief can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Nathan Handwerker, now you know this better be a good story with a name like that. Nathan Handwerker put in a new food stand in 1916 in Coney Island. Handwerker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors, but he priced his at 5 cents. The other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior and attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. The free products furthered the perception that the value must be substandard. Then Handwerker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes, and he raised his prices. His hot dogs started selling. People assumed that if physicians were eating his food and it cost at least as much as his competitors, it had to be good. So Nathan's famous hot dogs began selling well and became a national phenomenon. They still exist today. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take some period of time. It can occur quickly, or it can take years to complete. The process of changing a belief is just that, the process, not an event. It can be planned, though, step by step with incremental progress. That's exactly what we do as coaches. We specialize in change. It takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anybody else's. Don't compare your inside to somebody else's outside. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, and your progress with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it worth it. Your story, your life, is not a competition or a comparison. And you can always know the difference between dosing and timing and titrating from avoidance. In changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind as well as your brain. The choices generate the moment-by-moment life you create. The programming of your internal map of reality, your software, will determine that journey. At any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors, and we know this now. And listen up, because this is some amazing stuff that's happened in the very last few years. Neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focused attention. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. We're going to come back in a later seminar about the genes. DNA downloads its information from expression of its code. We now know it can go in the other direction. Our experiences, even our beliefs, can turn genes on or turn them off to determine a major extent of the expression of DNA-based information. That's how powerful a new story can be. And here's a final thought. What remains unconscious will be attributed to fate. Okay, we have some time for discussion. I'm interested in your take on this, your experiences and thoughts.
How do you bring, this is Lynn,
yes.
This bringing things to consciousness, do you have a methodology for that, or is it just a matter of being honest and looking clearly at yourself through meditation? I mean,
let's talk about how we do that.
It just seems like everything needs. Pardon me.
I'm sorry, I didn't know I talked over you. Go ahead, finish.
It just seems like in so many things I'm reading and studying right now, it's all about bringing things that are unconscious to consciousness.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how we do that with clients. And one way of thinking about this is a way that I used to describe listening to a patient, to medical students who came through psychiatry when I was at Baylor College of Medicine, listen until you hear something that doesn't make sense, and then get curious with your patient together about it. And that still kind of applies. Listen until you hear something that seems like a coachable moment. For example, let's go back to that equation, beliefs drive behavior, behavior drives performance. If someone is noticing that they have a compromised performance, then look at the antecedent to understand what's the behavior that can help us understand what may be compromising the performance. Then if there's a behavior that's compromised or less than ideal, let's look at the belief that is creating that behavior. Remember, beliefs are the software that drive behavior. So we're looking then at something that someone may not necessarily be conscious about. We're not in coaching. We are not trying to delve into the unconscious. We're dealing only with derivatives. We're only dealing with what's manifest right now in what somebody says or thinks or feel. Mm-hmm. So whatever we hear, now there may be some belief that's ghostwriting a certain behavior, but we highlight that behavior and then we get curious about it together. Or we hear something that's not working, we get curious about it together. We're collaborating about understanding something, because only the client can tell you what something really means in his or her life. They are an expert on their life. We can get curious together, we can collaborate, but we can't tell them how they feel or what their motivation is or what their unconscious is. We get curious together, and this is simply, and I'm saying all that I'm saying in these seminars just to inform your listening, and not anything more than that. And when your listening is informed, you'll be able to have, and you already do, to have the contingent conversations that you have with a client. Think about what you do with clients that makes coaching so magical, so powerful. You have contingent conversations. You're focusing, your point of reference is the client and what's going to help that client achieve goals, achieve everything that will facilitate those goals, including self-awareness, understanding, being able to think about how they think. And your role is to facilitate that, to be a collaboration partner in doing that, and to be an accountability partner for what they plan and commit to themselves, not to you, so that they can pursue goals and make an action plan of it, so they can put it into behavior, perhaps new behavior, and into different performance. Now, does that even begin to answer the question that you ask, Lynn?
Well, yes, sort of.
Okay. Well, we've got a beginning. Is there more to it, or more of a clarification of the question that? Or does anybody else
have?
Well,
you say what remains unconscious will be our fate. Is that what you said?
Yeah, we'll attribute it to something. We're gonna make sense of whatever is there. We're gonna make it make sense and light on something that makes it make sense. So it may be attributed to fate. You know, for example, if you let me give you guys a quiz. This is from the Wharton, and this is going to be an illustration of your question and the principle behind it. So keep that in mind, because it's not
okay.
Going to sound like it's going to get there. This is a quiz to everybody. Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals on their fees. Now, whether someone accepts or declines your professional services, which of these do you think has the highest impact on their decision? Credential, reputation, experience, amount of the fee, or state of the economy? What's your guess? Anybody?
Amount of the fee.
Okay, good guess. What? Any other guesses?
Credentials. What was the second one?
Credentials, okay. Reputation, experience, amount of the fee, state of the economy. I think that's the way I said it. Other guesses?
I probably would guess experience.
Okay. All right. You ready for the answer? None of the above. It's how you state your fee clearly and confidently. And let me elaborate about both of these, because I think these are both answers to your question in a roundabout way. The credibility of professionals is hurt. If they're fuzzy about fees, it damages the trust that the client has. There's attribution about fuzziness. So for most people, the issue isn't whether fees are high or low, but that the professional is clear, direct, specific, and confident. Now, the confident part, remember the Dan Gilbert study about subliminal language. This is a huge factor. The professional is confident in stating fees. That's why people want to sign on for you, because when you believe in them and it shows and you have a confidence in your ability to help them, they're going to want that. It's going to light on other things. It's going to make sense to them in different ways, and there's going to be all kind of reasons. But that's what we basically offer, I believe, is that we offer a belief in our client and work together until they can show us both why. And that confidence is conveyed in subliminal ways, yet it's very real. Now, if there's non-clarity or if there's a little bit lack of confidence, here's how that's going to sound. Well, I know I need to do coaching, but you know I have a cash flow problem right now, and I'll let me contact you the next quarter when my schedule is so busy now and through Christmas. Let me think about that and get back with you the first year. It's going to light on something that's going to make sense, because they're not lying, because it is busy. They do have a cash flow, but it's going to be a reason that's there at a very different level that they're not going to know about any more than the people in Dan Gilbert's study knew that the word elderly was flashed, and that's why they were walking a little bit more slowly. These other reasons made sense too, and they weren't lying. And we're going to have to stop in like 30 seconds, but let me just run this by real quick. There was a study that also showed this in a grocery store, a control study, and I won't go through all the details setting it up, but all the wines were controlled for price and all that. When Italian music was played, people bought 74% Italian wine. When French music was played, they bought 77% of their wines were French. When they were asked later, were they aware of the music? They were vaguely aware, but they weren't. And they were asked why they bought the wine they did, why the preponderance over all the others. I mean, there were like, you know, a dozen different kinds. And the vast majority was the music they were playing. They attributed it to, well, you know, I just know wine, and I appreciate French wines. And when they were told that the French music was playing, the people who bought the French wine said, well, that didn't influence me at all. Same with the Italian wines and the Italian music. That didn't influence me. This is the kind of wine I like. So they're going to make it make sense. So this is something we listen for, because our clients have made things make sense for so long. Now, I know we're not done, but we're out of time. If there are other questions, email me, or let's pick up here next time. I look forward to that. Look forward to resuming with you next time. Thanks for all of your energy and input. Thanks very, very much. Bye now.
Thank you.